I took a few moments this week to count down the number of Sundays we have left together. It isn't very many. I think once September starts, I will be in this pulpit about 15 times. And it felt kind of strange. Over the summer, I felt the shift, the distance increase a bit, and I'm looking on myself now just viscerally as the interim minister before the interim minister comes. So I'm really, this little chunk of time between now and the end of January will be its own little unit, and all that has come before, but this is a separate piece. So I stepped into the pulpit in the middle of the week when no one else in the church, and I said, old friend, be gentle and gracious to me in these few Sundays that remain, and be magnanimous and gracious to every voice that steps into this space from now on. Amen. Here's to a love that seeks not self and hath no censure for our frailty, but doth woo by gentle arts our spirits back into the way of truth, then sheds upon our lives a radiance that all else survives. Did you notice that King David's obituary was very short in that little reading? After all the famous phrases and great stories about King David that were laid out beforehand, his ruddy face, his red hair, the nearness that he was to the heart of God, his courage in the face of lion and bear and giant and all the rest of it, it came down to two lines. David died and was buried in the citadel of David. That's it. Obituary over. But further down the page, we came to the rather sanctimonious prayer of King Solomon, which to me rang very false. He spoke about a continuity of faithful service. Let me continue the faithful service in the spirit of my father, wrote the author. But underneath it, there was a self-serving power grab going on. It was him to be king. It was not someone else, his more worthy brothers. He offered 1,000 rams, says the story, not out of piety, but as a demonstration of his wealth. And he offered them in a sanctuary which was in effect a foreign sanctuary, a sanctuary to the culture, the broadest culture, that he might put his oar in the broadest of cultural waters and do well from them. He spoke about a false promotion of his own home life. How wonderful it was to be the son of a great king, he said. May my life shine even as a small facet of the greatness of my father. Well, his father's home life was terrible, terrible home life. All kinds of battles going on inside, rape and incest and murder among the children, and fractiousness among the variety of wives, and David being chased on the field and hounded at home. It was a terrible home life indeed. And there was a false humility in this prayer. O Lord, let me simply be your servant. Amen. And underneath is a voracious appetite to himself become a god. It's all there. You can see it in his son, Rehoboam, who came to the throne after Solomon's death. Rehoboam sat on the throne the first day and he said, you think my father was tough? You think my father was tough? The thickness of my little finger is thicker than my father's thigh. And as a response, the people of the land said, away to your tents, O Israel. We no longer have heritage in the line of David. Well, then follows the ever-popular propaganda that you find sometimes in the text. We hear the same propaganda being put out among us these days. Social power, it says, is a sign of God's blessing. If you got power, God loves you more than those who have no power. We hear that today. And richness and privilege equal divine intimacy. We hear that today. Those who are wealthy and privileged often feel and make us feel that they are closer somehow to the heart of God, and those of us who are out on the edges or very far out on the edges are at a distance from God. And the purpose of life, it says, is to accumulate and to do everything you can to deny our common mortality. Just gather as many things as you can and forget the idea that we are vulnerable and frail and only passing through. Then life will be good, it says. It is not the portraits of high noon, however, that tell the tale of our true life. It is what we do with the quiet intimacy of the morning. Some measure of balance can occur in all this by the first things we do in the morning, our intentional routine in the morning. Well, what's your routine in the morning like? I owe the chair of worship a great debt. About a year ago in July, as the anniversary year was coming up, Dr. Holness emailed me and said, well, since you're at the cottage anyway, why don't you start writing some things that can be used in the liturgy for next year? Why don't you write some calls to worship and some different aspects of the liturgy? And so I'd find myself getting up at 5:30 in the morning and going out to my little shed with a cup of coffee and writing down some things that came to me. And by the end of the day, I was sending her six sets of everything. And she sent an email a few days later and said, okay, I got the idea. But you see, I'd caught on by then, and I'm out there at 6:30 every morning writing things that come to mind. And then when I came back at the end of the summer, well, the pattern was set, so I'd get up at 6:30 in the morning, get the cup of coffee going, sit in the living room with my cell phone and write whatever comes to mind. And then a cousin of mine who lives in the north said, by the way, I'm keeping a hard copy of all these, and I want them at the end. And so this day, a year later, more than a year later, I'm up at 5:30, a quarter to six every morning, sitting with a cup of coffee and writing whatever comes to mind, thanks a lot to the chair of worship. But that's an important routine for me, to get up in the morning and to settle myself in the morning. It isn't something that I've done over the years. And I sit before a blank screen on the Facebook page, and the first set of words come, and then one set leads to another and another and another until it finishes itself, and then I put my three initials, GMS, at the bottom, put a title at the top, and send it off into hyperspace. Well, that's my morning. I realize that the basic issue in all our lives is hunger. Hunger. We wake up hungry. Every living thing is hungry. Every living thing needs nurture and nourishment every day, or it will die. Lay the biblical template of hunger over the text, and you see hunger everywhere. The children of Israel, slaves in Egypt, are hungry, and Pharaoh makes them create bricks without straw. You're hungry now, I'll make you hungrier still. It's a way of controlling you, said the Pharaoh. And in the wilderness, the children of Israel are wandering and hungry. There is no water, there is no bread. Where is God, they say. And the exiles, later on in their common history, are hungry. Hungry for a tradition they lost behind, hungry for a homeland they can no longer remember. And in the New Testament, the disciples are hungry and are often seen going off to the towns to buy food after Jesus has taught them for the day. And the crowds are hungry, coming by the thousands to see if there is some word from this Galilean preacher to help them in their hunger. And Jesus is hungry, kneeling out among the trees by himself in the middle of the night, praying to God for wisdom and strength to do that which he is called to do. And we in worship are hungry as well. All of us have come here this morning, perhaps not knowing exactly why we have, but hunger for baptism, hunger to belong, hunger to have life's questions answered, hunger to find some succor and some help, hunger and healing and strength. That's why we come. Well, the letter in the book of James writes, if your brother or sister lack daily food, and you say to them, go in peace, keep warm, and eat your fill, yet do not supply them with their bodily needs, what good is that? We've just changed provincial governments. I don't know how you feel about that. I think the reviews are starting to come in, and I think we are beginning to live in a province that is going to experience more hunger. A hunger for democracy and a broader representation, which seems to be being taken away, and a hunger for sexual safety and responsibility, which seems to be being rescinded, and a hunger for clean air and a sustainable web of life. Leave no trail, leave no garbage. We seem to be going back to older and more polluted ways. And the hunger for strength of shared resources to help people make ends meet who cannot make ends meet at the moment, and that seems to be being removed. We have a pharaoh, it seems, in the premier's chair, in which scarcity shall become the model. A Herod of social persecution, and personal vendettas against perceived critics. Have we not seen enough of that in Washington? Have we not seen enough of that in the dictatorships of the world? Are we not tired and terrified of it at the same time? The pandering to vested interests and narrow ideologies which starve our common life, hunger in the province and the world. If your brother and sister are hungry, feed them, says the text. Find out what the need is. See the need. See it without spinning it. See it without scoring points about it. Seeing without judging it. Act to feed the hunger. Address to feed the hunger that is in all of us. It is the simplest of prime directives. So what is the first thing you put into your body, mind, and spirit in the morning? What's the first thing you give yourself for nourishment? Be careful here. I wanted to go to Florida one year, and way back in 1990, in the middle of summer, Elspeth and I drove to Florida. We wanted it hot. Well, we got it hot. It was about 40 degrees Celsius. You couldn't even touch the steering wheel when we got there. We lived inside a condominium all day long and came out like little creatures at about 8 o'clock at night and went to a Chinese food store and bought food and scurried back into the air conditioning. All we did was watch movies every day, rented movies and watched them, about 15 movies a day. And so Bugs Bunny blended in with Caligula, and I couldn't tell you anything we'd watched. By the end of it, we wanted it hot. On the way down to Florida, we stopped in a hotel and stayed overnight, and we went to the breakfast buffet. Well, they had everything. And I piled up my oatmeal, and I put nuts and fruit and syrup and bananas and cherries and more syrup and whipped cream and ice cream on the top, and I came back and ate it with a cup of coffee. And then at the end of the month, we came back by the other route from Florida, went into a similar kind of restaurant, and I loaded up with the oatmeal, and then I saw a few other things, and I sprinkled them on. And then I saw an apple compote, which looked absolutely wonderful. And I scooped 3 great spoonfuls of apple compote on the top of my porridge. And I noticed the server looking at me sort of sideways. And I smiled at her and said, "Good morning, dear." And I put some cream on it and went back to the table and took a bite. And it was home-fried potatoes. I covered my porridge with home-fried potatoes. And I poured them into the palm plant, which was next door to the table. I think it died later in the week. Be careful what you put inside. You might begin your day with self-delusion from the night before. Is this the way I left the furniture in disarray? Are all these my dirty dishes in the sink? We might start with the shock of headlines, the cruelty and accidents and injustice and arrogance of the world around us and within. These can break our spirits before we're even awake. We can say to ourselves, "I am so alone. I am so unknown here. I'm too old. I'm too small. I'm too uninformed. I have no voice. I have no right to think and to speak." And yet we know, don't we? We know the great voices when we hear them. I know you were noting that Aretha Franklin died this week. I don't remember a whole lot about Aretha Franklin, and yet I remember at Iona in the kitchen dancing to R-E-S-P-E-C-T with a broom and dancing all around the room. I'm still noted for that over there and am not allowed to work there ever again, but it was a great experience to dance to R-E-S-P-E-C-T with a broom in the kitchen of a Scottish island. But we laud Aretha Franklin. We laud what she sang, bringing presidents to tears with her 4-octave voice. I read somewhere on the internet that she had sung Nessun Dorma once, my favorite Pavarotti piece, with full orchestra and chorus, and I looked it up on YouTube. Look it up, Aretha Franklin, Nessun Dorma, and listen to her lift that song to new heights, and the notes at the end bring chills to your spine and tears to your eyes. We know greatness when we hear it. St. Paul writes, "Let love be genuine, hate what's evil, hold fast to what's good, love one another with mutual affection, contribute to the needs of the saints, extend hospitality to the stranger. If your enemies are hungry, feed them. If they're thirsty, give them something to drink. Do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good." The letter to the Ephesians came out of the city of Ephesus, obviously. Ephesus was a beautiful city in the Greco-Roman world. We traveled there as tourists a few years ago, and although only about 10% of it has been excavated from the 40 meters of ooze that covers it over the centuries, you will find there a main street. The shops are all still showing, and there are tiles, beautiful colored tiles, in the floors of the shops. And there's a great forum there from which St. Paul spoke. And to this day, you can stand on the very top row and someone can whisper down on the stage and you can hear every single word, though it is 100 meters to the top. And there was a large statue unearthed of the Roman emperor with his foot on the neck of an enemy holding a round globe, a symbol of Roman power in the world. And there was even a public toilet there. We recognized it right away. You could even sit in the little stalls if you like. Nobody did. And the guide was telling us that there was even social protocol there, too. The rich people got to sit in the first hole because that's where the fresh water came through. It went around in a circle. And if you were poor, you got to sit in the last hole, and nobody wanted to do that. Well, life hasn't changed very much, has it? And there was even another building there, and I was the one who recognized it. The guide said, "Anybody know what that is?" I said, "I think it's a brothel." He said, "Yes, it is." Well, no one would speak to me on the coach for the rest of the trip. How in the world did the minister know where the brothel was? Well, and we noticed that on the sidewalk down near the harbor, etched in the stone, was a symbol to tell sailors how to get to the brothel. You just follow the picture of the little blonde girl and the arrow and the footprint going to the right, go over the hill, and you're there. Well, there were other symbols in the street as well. One looked like a pizza with several slices cut in it. And the guide said to us, "That is the symbol for a Christian church. In the ancient city of Ephesus, that was the symbol of Jesus Christ, Son of God, Savior. And when you walked up the street, you would see the symbol carved into the sidewalk. And then you would look at the green plant in front of the house, a plant called a narthex, by the way, and the church would happen beyond the narthex. And to this day, we walk through the narthex of the church to get into the nave." So even in those ancient days, early Christians in Ephesus, in the midst of all the rest of it, would gather together early in the morning for breakfast and study and prayer and simply to be together and to mark the measure of their community and pledge to serve one another and Christ and to be good citizens of their city. And one would say to the other, "Be wise today and be careful out there. It's a tough world. There's gang warfare out there. There's gunfire in the underground garages and bullets flying in the children's playgrounds. There are mentally unstable shooters bringing down police and lovers in small Canadian cities. There are assassins in the public street shooting people down as they eat their meals on a quiet evening. I stood at the gate of the year and said, 'Give me a light that I may tread safely into the darkness.' And he replied, 'Go out into the darkness and put your hand into the hand of God. That shall be to you better than the light and safer than the known way.' So I went forth and, finding the hand of God, trod gladly into the night. And he led me towards the hills and the breaking of the day in the lone east." Minnie Louise Haskins wrote that in 1908 as a poem for her father. She was 13 years old, and she got it, and so did the people at Ephesus. "Put into your body that which favors your health," says the text. "Beware of chemical intoxication," it said. "It leads to stagnation and dissipation." As Ringo Starr would sing in one of those old Beatles songs, "No, no, 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 I don't drink it no more. I'm tired of waking up on the floor." Beware of the abuses of self or others in sexual assault, the text says, or emotional violence, the text says. The harm done may never go away. Let the song you sing be the one that rings through your sweetest heart. Does the song you sing early in the morning repel people or attract them? Well, what do you say? If you go around singing "Dust in the Wind," We're only dust in the wind, or we're just another brick in a wall, or with a rebel yell she cried more, 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 or born to be wild, you're going to drive people away. But if you sing from a distance, or what a wonderful world, or perhaps the song by the Platters with which I used to dance at 15 with the 15-year-old love of my life, as the words spilled out my prayer and the answer you give, may they still be the same for as long as we live. Ah, just a moment, I'm going to savor that for a second before I speak to you again. Now, does this all sound too churchy to you? Is this what you'd expect the church to say? Well, it's about time the church said it. Get over it, because that is the message the church was called to say. Into a culture like this, and in every culture, there are anchor truths here, and the church has fought long and hard and laid down its life to be able to speak them. We too easily forget that we're the only one of us that will ever be, that we carry a particular perspective in all human life, and no one else has it but you and me. We can choose to follow our best nature. We can become microscopes to lift up small things that no one sees, or we can become telescopes that show vast mysteries and eternal purpose that other people seem to miss. We create a free space for the creativity in everyone we meet. Be imitators of God, says the text, as we love children and live in love. Well, we began by noting the brief obituary of King David. And I was thinking that an obituary is a singular thing. It is one impression of a life. It is an intentional, filtered selection that is carried through the mind of someone writing it. The range, experience, and expressions of one writing it tell others who that person thinks we are. It isn't the whole truth. It isn't the whole person. An obituary is a portrait from the starting point of somebody else's evaluation and memory. So I was thinking that we write obituaries of Jesus. Indeed, the Gospels are obituaries of Jesus. They are perceptions of a loved one who tragically died. That's an obituary. And the letters of the New Testament are reflections of the implications of that life, new ways of being ourselves because we have met and engaged that life. So I was thinking there is an evangelical obituary of Jesus, and it would contain the following things. Jesus was someone of moral judgment, who uplifted family values, who rewarded obedience, who expected a clean heart and clean hands and a clean slate. A tight Jesus, a Jesus who would brook little falling or little failing, a Jesus who demands that we make amends to God in every turn. And then there's the social justice community service obituary. Jesus spent time in the far country, it says. Jesus wrestled with street temptations, as we all do, it says. Jesus found broad companions in common causes. Jesus called down the arrogant and the ruling elite and had the expression that said, anyone who is not against us is for us. That's very broad. And then there's the mystical, philosophical obituary of Jesus. Jesus was a thinker. Jesus was a dreamer. He sat at the feet of sages. He felt himself to be a child of mystery. He took time of retreat for private prayers. He had a long view of time and eternity, and even pain and loss are within the redemptive realm of God, he said. He achieved nirvana, Valhalla, heaven. He was given the name that is above every name. That's the mystic philosophical obituary. And we all have our own personal obituaries of Jesus that we live. I was thinking of mine. My Jesus is perceptive. My Jesus is a thinker. My Jesus is a big picture visionary, compassionate, a cross bearer. My Jesus breaks barriers to see and support real people where he finds them. He is one who braved the terror and threats imposed by the powerful. Death is not the final word, he would say. Trust is the great instrument in life. To write an obituary, you have to have braved life. Even the taste of it is a start. We have a grandchild, Kate, and we call her the pasta girl because all she's ever eaten in her 9 years is pasta. And she eats pasta morning, noon, and night. And at the table at the cottage, we'll say, would you like to try an oyster? Oh, brother, maybe that's a bit of a leap. Would you like to try pasta with a bit of ketchup on it? And, well, I don't think so. How about pasta with a little meat on the side, a bit of chicken? No, well, I don't think so. But slowly over time, this little girl will try this and will try that until she develops a full palate later on in life. Well, that's what you have to do with Jesus. Jesus is not fast food. Jesus is not served through some drive-through window along the way. This culture has forgotten about Jesus Christ and has placed all kinds of very strange concepts in his place. And now it's time to taste and see that the Lord is good. Jesus is a slow, simmering breakfast, like a hearty porridge, eaten alone in thoughtful moments or with friends planning a wondrous day. Jesus is the all-day breakfast from the hot griddle of God. How's that for a definition for you? So here is faith in a phrase. You were hungry and I fed you, says God. And here is the response to faith in a phrase. When you did it to the least of my brothers and sisters, you did it to me. The community of faith is one that enjoys and offers the breakfast of champions around a common table. If your brother and sister is hungry, we're all hungry. Here then is the divine directive. In the face of bad news or rough press clippings that curl your hair, or the systematic deception and bullying of people at the top, taste and see that the Lord is good. There's the directive. And if your brother and sister is hungry, feed them.